Well, a workshop's off to a really great start when you're on the first talk and you're already 15 minutes late. So I'll talk twice as fast as I had anticipated talking.
No, I'm
just kidding. I'm just kidding. But I mean, since Axel isn't giving a talk, we'll have a little bit of time to catch up if we need to. So I noticed that I had one of the shortest talk titles on the program, but then I noticed there was an even shorter one, and it was something like The Paradox of the Cichlids. And so I figured I'd shorten my title even further just so I could have the distinction, in at least one sense at this conference, of having the shortest title. Although I realize now that as the first speaker, anyone has the potential to make their title even shorter. So what I'd like to do is talk about the role of niches in driving speciation in Darwin's finches. So we can sort of conceptualize the role of the niche within this group and more generally using a particular pathway of effects. And the specific effects that I'm going to show you are ones that are especially relevant in Darwin's finches and that we can also measure in Darwin's finches, but they also make sense in a general context. So this starts potentially, at least, with different niches. So organisms start to occupy different niches. Now, this is part you won't normally see, and that is that these niche differences select for different performance capabilities, that is, your ability to do well in that particular niche. So it should be divergent selection on performance, and I'm going to have performance measures in my data set, which is why I wanted to include that explicitly. Now, it's those performance differences that then indirectly lead to selection on traits, because the traits are what determine your performance on those different niches. And then those trait differences in particular, coupled with performance differences, can potentially contribute to several different reproductive barriers. And so here I've shown, where's the pointer? Is it, does someone have, do you still have the pointer? Well, if someone finds the, here's a laser pointer anyway. Thank you. Okay, so it can lead to a couple of different reproductive barriers, or any number of them, and the two that I specifically want to mention are selection against hybrids, because they're not well suited for either of the parental niches, as well as the potential for assortative mating based on the traits that underwent divergent adaptation. And then, of course, combined, these things all add up to ecological speciation. So I'm going to try and flesh out this framework for Darwin's finches, and in doing so, address three key questions. So Darwin's finches, as you know, are sort of the canonical example, or one of them anyway, about how differences in niches drive speciation. So you have 14 recognized species, and they're all adapted, seemingly, for feeding on a different food type. And they show specializations of bill size and shape for using those different resources. So within this group, presumably, we should have a really good way of understanding how niches influence the process of speciation. So the three key questions I want to use this group to address. The first one is, are there niche differences, and to what extent are they, between the existing species? Presumably, if niche differentiation drove the speciation event in the first place, they should still be differentiated by niche. But importantly, did this niche differentiation occur during the course of speciation itself, or did it simply accumulate after the fact? So in order for niche differences to be the driver of speciation, they have to be present right at its very early stages. And then third, how sensitive is this niche differentiation to changing environmental conditions, both among the species and in the process of diversification at this very outset? So those are the three key questions I want to address in the three sections of my talk. So here's a selection of the Darwin's finches, and you could look at any number of them, and they're all doing a variety of different things, but I'm going to concentrate on one particular part of this radiation, and that is the seed-eating ground finches. So here you have the small ground finch, Fuliginosa, you have the medium ground finch, Fortis, and you have the large ground finch, Magnarostris. Also included in this group is the cactus finch, Geospiza scandens. But this one will appear in several of my slides, but not in all of them. This is the primary focus. Now, these finches are all very closely related. They're sort of at the tips of the Darwin's finch phylogeny. They all still interbreed, and they do, to some extent, feed on similar foods. So this is sort of an intermediate stage, if you will, in the adaptive radiation process. I'll go even at a lower scale in when I look at diversification within this one grouping. So just generally, methods, of course, you know, they're typical things. You go out and you capture a bunch of birds, you measure a bunch of things on them, take blood samples for DNA, then you put individual marks on them, let them go, and then you walk around and find out what they're doing, and then you come back years later and find out who lived and who died, how many kids did they have, things like that. So standard basic field methods coupled with some simple population genetics. So the first thing then is I talked about, you know, you have performance differences, trait differences, and niche differences. And so let's just go in the opposite order with respect to the finches, because that's what's already reasonably well known. So we know that they differ in beak shape. And so we looked at this with geometric morphometrics. And here's an example of a bunch of different finch species. They're all on the same island. And you have clusters in the first principal component of beak shape, which goes from deep and robust beaks to long and thin beaks. Relative to the absolute overall size of the beak. And this is the three species I've been talking about, the small ground finch, the medium ground finch, and the large ground finch. And then Scandens has a beak more like that, so it's off on a different angle. Now, this particular variation presumably relates to performance differences. So, by the way, I should point out, of course, that Peter and Rosemary Grant have done a lot of this work, and we duplicated what they did and then addressed other questions. So what about performance differences then? So the idea would be that these different beaks allow them to do different things with different foods with different levels of success. And so one particularly important thing for seed-eating ground finches is how hard they can bite, because that will determine the size of the seed that they can crack. So we looked at this using bite force measurements. So you have a force plate, and then you get the finches to bite them, and then you record the force that they exert while doing the biting. Now, you can see there's huge variation. This is beak size here, and this is bite force here. These are three different species. And you can see these guys bite much, much, much harder than do these guys. And what's interesting is you didn't actually need a force plate to know that, because when you remove them from the nets, they tend to bite you. They really want to bite you. And I always said that, you know, it hurts, really. And so you can, you know, swear if you want, for any of them. But you cannot help but swear when the Magnarostris bites you. You just can't hold it in because it really hurts. So they do show performance differences which should relate to what they feed on and then is linked to their beak size. So what I want to ask then in particular is how do they differ in their niches? Now, Peter and Rosemary Grant have already shown that at least on some places they feed on different things, but we've looked at that in a more temporal and spatial context. So first, let's look at overall niche overlap based on all sites and years pooled. And this is just Pianca's niche overlap index. And these are different pairings, Magnarostris, Scandens, etc. Now, the general point I want to show you here is that these values range from high to modestly low. There's variation among them. But interestingly, if you run those Ecosim Gatelli-based simulations, you find that all of them show more overlap than would be expected by chance. Which is, of course, quite strange because we know that they seemingly differ in food types, and that's what drove the radiation. So we've come to the conclusion that this particular method is not a particularly sensitive one for determining niche differentiation. But let's look at it then. So here's niche overlap among these species. But the question is, although they show this high average niche overlap, is that typical? I mean, you can't really interpret it except in the context of, say, other birds that might feed on different food types. So we reviewed in the literature measures of Pianca's niche overlap for a whole bunch of different bird species, and they're hugely variable from very low overlap to very high overlap. These are all closely related groups. And the ranges for finches are somewhere in the middle. So I would conclude from this that our results are reasonably typical of other bird species. That is, they do feed to some extent on different things, but there's still some overlap. But what gets interesting is when you start to break that overlap out by space and time. And I'm going to emphasize on the time aspect. So if you take now each of these pairings, Magnarostris, Scandens, etc., and you calculate niche overlap in different sites and different years, you see there's huge variation in it. So, for instance, in this contrast here, in some sites there's very low overlap, and in some sites there's very high overlap for the same species pair. So this suggests that there's high spatial and temporal variation niche overlap, which we're trying to argue is one of the things that can maintain these groups in sympatry if they have spatial and temporal variation in the extent to which they overlap. And here's the particularly interesting aspect of that, is that niche overlap is temporally structured through the data set. Early on, in the early years, 2003 and 2004, niche overlap was much lower than in the later years. So something happened during the course of that event. By the way, I should say niches are what they feed on, in case that wasn't clear. You see this incredible increase in the amount of niche overlap. And that coincides with changes in weather conditions. So in the early years, it was drought conditions with almost no rain, and in late years, there was a lot of rain. And so what this meant was that you went from very harsh conditions in the early years, where there was essentially almost no breeding plants and very few seeds, to situations where there were lots of breeding plants and lots of seeds in the subsequent years. So this suggests that you have increasing or decreasing niche overlap when you have increasing resource availability. So we think that what happens is that these niches, these finches retreat to their private niches, the things that they're best suited for during times when food conditions are poor. But when there's lots of food conditions, everybody just feeds on the same thing. So it appears to be these periodic intervals during low food availability when the niches really matter and adaptation to them. So just to show you that you can visualize diet variation, using principal components and other methods. And I'm going to show you, here are all the different samples for all the species. These are their diets for all the different species in different locations in different years. And I just want to show you that if you take several of the species, this is at one site called Garapatero. These are the Fortis. These are the Fuliginosa. There's other stuff in here too. And these are the Scandens. So even though there is spatial and temporal variation in niches, you do see that there's some consistency where you can take groups and say this is a particular site and species. And you can, of course, characterize which particular plant species coincide with differentiation of the different species. And just to show you more visually, this is basically what you find. As you would expect, the small ground finch, Fuliginosa, tends to feed mostly on small seeds. The medium ground finch tends to feed mostly on medium seeds, and the large ground finch is the only one that will feed on the very hard seeds. For instance, this is Cordia lutea, which it feeds on a lot, but it's the only finch species that can crack that seed. And then the cactus finch, as you might expect, specializes to a larger extent on cactuses than the other ones. So to summarize then this niche differentiation among the species, the first point is that the different species do not have the same diets. Okay? However, they do overlap considerably. That is, they're generalists much of the time. But that overlap is less in times of scarcity. So basically, they retreat to their private resources when needed. So it might be these occasional episodes of very high resource limitation. Those are the times when their niches matter and when adaptation is presumably driven and therefore contributing to ecological speciation. If you just go and sample them at any random time, you might find that there aren't big niche differences between them. Okay, so they differ in niches. But is that what drove the speciation in the first place, in the adaptive radiation? I mean, presumably it did, right? But if we really want to figure that out, we should try and grab something in the midst of a speciation event, where they're starting to split into two groups, and ask about the role of niches in that context. So we can do that because we found situations where there seems to be diversification within one species that's similar to that among the species. So here is a frequency histogram of beak size across all of those seed-eating ground finches, the three species, at one particular location. And you can conveniently divide this up, if you want, into the different recognized species. But what's interesting to us is that if you look at Fortis, you don't have a single unimodal distribution. Instead, you have a small morph, essentially, some intermediates, and then you have a little blip here of a large morph. And this is a very high variation compared to the other species, which suggests that maybe we can go and look right here at the processes that are driving speciation and what's causing them. So if you look at these are not trivial differences between the small and the large beak version. I would suggest that if these were continental birds, you probably would have called them different species. And I should also point out that this is not mistakenly identified as a Fortis when it's really a Magna Rostris, because if you take that same individual bird and turn it around and compare it to a Magna Rostris, you see there's another jump up in the robustness and size of the beak. So we wanted to study this bimodal population as a way of understanding speciation, and we did so first at one particular location, Garapatero. So it's on the central island of Santa Cruz at this particular location. The main town, Academy Bay, is over here, and this is what it looks like here. It's a relatively undisturbed site. There's some introduced goats and donkeys, but there's no other human influence. So then the first thing we wanted to do was to ask, you know, if niches are driving this diversification, first let's look for the signals that we would expect of ongoing speciation. First, we might expect that there would be selection against hybrids. These are the boxes in my diagram. Selection against hybrids, assortative mating, and the combination of those two things should reduce gene flow. Then once we've established those things, that would suggest to us that this is the beginning of diversification. They would be similar to that among the species, and then we can ask about the role of niches in that diversification. So first I'm going to show you evidence as to whether or not the intermediate birds, that is, those ones in that dip in the middle, are surviving at lower rates, so selection against hybrids, that each morph is preferring to mate with its own morph, smalls with smalls and larges with larges, within this one species. And then that there is, if there's any reproductive isolation between them, that we might be able to detect with neutral genetic markers. And then finally ask if they're feeding on different foods, which would be suggestive that that's the process that's driving the diversification. So what about selection against hybrids? So basically this is a test for disruptive selection, disruptive viability-based selection. So you ask about survival from one year to the next in relation to beak size within the Fortis only. And normally when you test for disruptive selection, you would expect you test for something like that, for a quadratic fit to the data. But if you remember, there's a competing species on the small side and the large side. And so perhaps you might expect something like this, where the small beak morph has the highest fitness, has high fitness, the large beak morph has high fitness, intermediates do poorly, and maybe if you're too big or too large, you also do poorly because you're potentially competing with the smaller and larger congeners, which we saw feed on roughly the same thing. So we tested that by marking individuals and looking at their survival from one year to the next. So we have three different selective episodes that I can show you data for, and I'm just going to basically use a cubic spline to plot survival probability versus beak size. So remarkably, it looks like that two-hump function. So you see that the small birds have relatively high fitness, the large birds have relatively high fitness, and the intermediate birds do relatively poorly. There's also evidence that if you're too large or too small, you also do poorly. So you could also visualize this as stabilizing selection around the two peaks. And then if you create a hybrid between the two peaks, it's going to have low fitness. And you see roughly similar patterns in the other selection episodes, the key point being there's always low fitness of the intermediate-sized birds. So what about mating isolation? Now, I didn't mention this earlier, but one thing that's nice about beak size in Darwin's finches is that it's coupled to mating isolation. For instance, the size of your beak will determine by biomechanical properties the type of song you sing. And female offspring in the nest imprint on the song of their father, as do the male offspring, and then the male offspring sing a song similar to that of their father. So as soon as beak divergence occurs, you should get mating isolation. So we tested this by looking for a bunch of paired birds and measure the beak size of the male and the beak size of the female and just simply relate female beak size to male beak size. So we did that a number of different years and different conditions, and essentially you see always strong assortative mating. The large beak birds tend to mate with the large beak birds and the small beak birds tend to mate with the small beak birds. So here you have a situation where relatively few intermediates are being formed, and there's selection against those intermediates that are being formed. This would suggest that the large and the small beak morphs should show some reproductive isolation that we might be able to detect using neutral genetic markers. And so in the analysis we did of this, we had 9 microsatellite loci, and here's just a bunch of results from that analysis. Here are some of the general statistical properties. You see these values are not really high, but neither are they consistent with panmixia. If you look at overall genotypic space, you see a fair amount of overlap. They are closely related conspecific groups, after all. But you see a distribution of the one morph over here and a distribution of the other morph mainly over there. And if you ask structure to classify the genomes of individuals into two groups, and you do that for the large beak morph, the small beak morph, and you add in a few of the small species and the large species, you get a lot of overlap, but you clearly have an increased assignment of the large morph and the large species to one group, and the small morph and the small species to the other group. So this is all by way of suggesting that you have a continuum of divergence from within species to between species. So now let's go and ask if there's niche differentiation between those two morphs. Are they feeding on different foods? So to do that, we used the same data set as before, except now we had individually banded birds that we tracked over multiple years and did a whole series of independent observations of what they're feeding on. And I'm just going to show you one quick plot of the results for here because I'm going to return to it in the third section of the talk. So do they differ in diet? And the answer is yes. They show us reasonable amount of overlap, once again, as we expect. But there's a series of food types that the small morph tends to feed on at a higher frequency and a series of food type that the large morph tends to feed on at a higher frequency. Suggesting that there's diversification that's occurring here in diets at the very early stages of the process of divergence. So to summarize then, intermediate birds survive at lower rates. You have selection against hybrids that would be formed between the two groups. Each morph mates with its own morph at a higher frequency. They're reproductively isolated to the point we can pick it up in neutral genetic markers, and they do feed on somewhat different foods. So we've got a building up a story here of how diversification is proceeding. We essentially find evidence for all of these links in this particular group. I should also point out that they do differ in bite force as well, so the two morphs have very different bite forces that would be consistent with their beaks and what they feed on. So the final thing is then, how sensitive are these changes, are these effects to changing environmental conditions? So I made the argument for the different species that it's those times of scarcity that really matter, those times of difficult situations, suggesting that there might be a certain fragility to the process that might be occurring between those two morphs. That is, it might be really sensitive to the specific conditions that they're experiencing. So I wanted to present to you evidence that that's the case by comparing two different sites now, and we're still working with the large and the small morph of the Fortis. Academy Bay, which is where the main town is, and there's a very large town off this direction here, contiguous with this, what you see, versus Garapatero, where there's essentially undisturbed environment. Now, what's interesting about this is that Academy Bay, the finches have started feeding on things that they wouldn't normally feed on, and they do so extremely frequently. For instance, here's a large Fortis that's feeding on potato chips outside our dormitory at the Charles Darwin Research Station, and here are a whole bunch of birds of different species and different beak sizes all feeding on rice, which can be cracked by any of them. And there are a whole bunch of people that put out these rice feeders, including on the research station, which we found. As soon as we published our work on this, all of a sudden their feeding things went into the backyard instead of the front yard. It was pretty funny. So here's what we found. First, if you look at Garapatero, the data I showed you before, for one particular year, you see this dip in the middle. It was less dramatic in the previous ones because I was pooling all years. And if you look back at Academy Bay in 1968, you see the same thing. I think it's so cool that these data are from the year I was born. I think it was so cool that somebody was out there collecting data for me, like while I was being born. It's pretty awesome. So you see that, but now let's ask about Academy Bay in the present, now that they've had these many years of human influence. And essentially what you see is that that dip is no longer present. Now, you still don't see a single unimodal distribution, but there's a much higher frequency of the intermediate beaked birds. So we've argued that this is because humans are changing the resource distribution, messing up the adaptive landscape, and thereby removing divergent selection against the intermediates that are being formed. So I showed you, let's give you what background I have now on the Academy Bay birds. I showed you before that there were some genetic differences for Garapatero between the two morphs. But if you look at Academy Bay, there's essentially nothing going on. So they are also less reproductively isolated to the extent that we don't pick up real differences in neutral markers. We have not looked at assortative mating and disruptive selection yet in this group because it's much harder to work at Academy Bay. But this would be suggestive of that those mechanisms have also broken down. But what are the role of niches in this? Are collapsed niches the reason? Because there could be any number of effects that are occurring associated with humans that are causing these differences. By the way, I wanted to mention that I have many, many sites, many years in addition to those three I showed you. And the pattern is the same. So essentially, here's the argument then. At Garapatero, you have close links between niche differences, performance differences, and beak differences, but that is all broken down at Academy Bay because now you have humans screwing up the resource distribution. So we tested that by looking at relationships between diet and performance, diet and morphology, and performance and morphology at these two different sites. With the expectation that all those relationships would be weaker for the Academy Bay birds. All those linkages that have driven speciation or driving speciation are breaking down. So first, I'll just show you, if you categorize Academy Bay and birds and Garapatero birds into large and small morphs, and you look at what the size, the hardness of the seeds that they're feeding on, and how hard they're biting. So two different measures of links between morphology and niche and morphology and performance. First, the large morph eats harder seeds at Garapatero, but not at Academy Bay. So this is a small morph, large morph. There's no difference between them in Academy Bay, but there's a big difference between them at Garapatero. So the large morph birds are no longer feeding on hard seeds at Academy Bay. Moreover, we don't see an interaction between sight and morph when it comes to their bite force. However, we do see that both the small and the larges bite harder at Garapatero than at Academy Bay, suggesting an overall weakening of the selection to be able to bite hard at Academy Bay. What about diet differences? Here's what I showed you before for Garapatero. Fair amount of overlap, but some separation. If you look at Academy Bay, it all breaks down. They're feeding on roughly the same thing, and these are the natural foods. We've also shown that they're also feeding on a whole bunch of human foods at an even higher frequency. What about diet performance correlations? So here's an association at Garapatero between how hard they bite and how hard the seeds are that they eat, and it's fairly strong. The nature of the data means that you're never going to get a very tight relationship here. But what about at Academy Bay? Well, the relationship is weaker. There's still some association, but it's weaker than at Garapatero. What about morphology performance correlations? If you're going to bite on hard things and bite hard, then you need to have a big beak to resist the forces that might otherwise fracture your beak. So indeed, at Garapatero, the ones with the big beaks are the ones that are biting hard. And the same is true at Academy Bay, but it's once again considerably weaker. Now, if you combine all of these things into a multivariate analysis, you get a representation of the association between diet on these two axes and either how hard they bite or their beak size. And you see that there's a very strong association between diet and beak size and performance and beak size at Garapatero, but not at Academy Bay. So this does seem to be the case, that you've had a breakdown of the association between all of these things associated with a human-induced perturbation of the environment. So we do have a story like this, but the key point is, I think, that it's temporally variable. And so I think that that's an important component of niche theory modeling that would be really valuable. We've confirmed the basic story, but added in this temporally variable aspect. And just to show you what we're doing as well, is we're asking to what extent are those niche differences driven by competition per se versus bimodal underlying resource distributions. And we're doing that partly by redoing all these analyses, but including all of the finch species in the same analysis. This is more data. And then we're also asking about whether or not the evolution of trait differences feeds back on niche differences, as we would expect to be important in the case of competition. So as they evolve bigger beaks, do they then deplete harder seeds from the environment? And just to show you one thing we're doing with that, we've got finch exclosures where we keep the finches out. And we are seeing effects such that if you keep the finches out, then you see many fewer cracked seeds in these enclosures, suggesting that the finches really are depleting things in their environment And if you keep them out, then you see an effect of finches. And the next question is, do you see an effect of finch beak size? So hopefully, you know, when I give this talk 5 years from now, I can fill in those other arrows as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bilushan. Very good way to fire off this workshop. And I think, you know, as a report, I'll give one such. We're almost out of time. Yes.
What do you think, what regulates the population growth on in Academic Bay?
I don't know. I guess you said, what do I think? Okay, so I'll have to guess then. Well, for instance, breeding territories might be limited, particularly in the vicinity of the town. So we do see that a bunch of birds basically sort of come into the town every day and then go out. So maybe it's just a physical space limitation. Maybe that has limited them. They're much more abundant at Academy Bay as well.
But then there is no food limitation.
Well, the town has so much food that it can support many more birds than otherwise, but I don't think then the food that's being provided in the town is being limited by the finches. I don't think the finches are structuring the environment in the town itself. They might be in the surrounding areas.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and we'll move on.